Sure. So my dog definitely does not fit everybody's cup of tea. I'm on the English Pointer side of things, and I can tell you right now, I love big running dogs. That has its pros and cons. Like if I'm hunting Utah, like I'm hunting with mountain goats in some of the area there, it's brutal looking down at your Garmin and seeing that your dog is 700 yards on point over three canyons working up one ridge. I know my pointer is working on that next ridge over, and so if he goes all the way up that ridge and there's no point, well, I don't have to worry about that side. And then he'll come over and work this right ridge and the next ridge over, because he'll work the ridge I'm on, the next ridge, and the next ridge over. And it's always that fourth or fifth ridge over that's like, okay, crap, now we're finding birds.
Where else can you go to not only find the information on how to train your dog, but the best deals on training equipment as well? Standing Stone Supply has everything you need to create that next versatile champion, from DT system electronics down to even emergency med kits to take with you on your hunting trips. If you need some help with your training program, then their step-by-step online course might be a great fit for you, making it a convenient one-stop shop for the knowledge as well as the gear to take your training to the next level. Hit up standingstonesupply.com and promo code GDIY will save you 10%.
As someone who constantly travels to new locations out of state to hunt, I have to rely on map scouting before I even get in the truck. Onyx Hunt Maps makes it super easy for me to plan out my trips as well as track my success while on the trip. The offline maps, along with the tracking feature and ability to add pictures to my waypoints, means I can always reference old trips and hunts to better prepare for the next. When planning your next hunt, be sure to use Onyx to put you and your dog in the best situation you can. Use code GDIY20 at checkout to save 20% and know where you stand with Onyx.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of GDIY presented by Standing Stone Supply. My guest this episode is Tyson Bowden. Tyson, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Living the dream as always. So I'm glad we're finally making this happen. This has been kind of I think you win the trophy for the hardest episode to coordinate, because we've been going on this for like 2 months prior to hunting season. But I'm glad finally able to nail each other down and make it happen.
Yeah, I'm with you. I know it's been a long road to get here, but hey, we're making it happen now. So it's all that matters.
Right. It was kind of interesting because you and I had talked a while ago, and then a listener randomly came up and recommended you for an episode. Apparently you had helped him out with some kind of training boogers and stuff that he had going on with his dog, and he mentioned you. I'm like, yeah, I've spoken to him before, and we talked briefly about possibly doing an episode, and it's just kind of funny how everything comes full circle. I can't recall the listener's name. I don't know if you do off the top of your head or not.
I think the name's Brock.
Okay.
I mean, I've helped a lot of people, so, but I'm pretty sure his name's Brock.
So. Yeah. So you are a pro trainer, at least part-time, I should say.
I don't know if I would say pro. I mean, I have a lot of pigeons and a bunch of time on my hands. So I love helping new people and just help work out some of those buggers that people have with their dogs. And I'm more one-on-one and kind of just go with the flow and see if we can get that dog steadied up and ready for bird season.
Nice. So you don't take in dogs for like a big giant program or a month or two at a time. You mainly focus on one-on-one sessions with the actual dog owners.
Exactly. Yeah. I look at it a lot as, I mean, when I was coming into it, I always was looking for someone to help me out. And so I wanted to be that for people that are starting or, are new into the bird hunting and the lovely dog side of things. And so I like just be that resource for people. And then, like I said, I've got tons of homing pigeons and I've accessed a bunch of other birds that we can use to train and get the dogs ready to go.
Yeah. And have you found throughout the people that you have helped throughout the years, how long have you been doing it? Has it been years, or is this just kind of in the past year or season, so to speak?
For sure. So I've been helping people for just a handful of years now. Yeah, I've been doing a lot by myself. I mean, and then helping my dad and me and just going that route. But I just love helping everyone else help accomplish their goals.
Right. So with you doing it for a handful of years and you really doing it the one-on-one way rather than, I guess, the typical or the more tried and true drop your dog off, see in a couple months type of environment. Have you kind of, in your opinion, seen more buy-in or ownership from the actual owners and handlers with the dog? You know, that they have more skin in the game because they're right there with you and the dog. Whereas I know a lot of dog trainers, they'll kind of gripe, but then in the same breath say it's just job security. When they send a dog home, they get upset because it's kind of like the owners kind of unravel all the hard work they did. But at the same time, that's going to keep them coming back in years to come with, you know, annual church ups and knocking the rust off and tune ups, if you will.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. With the one-on-ones, I know a lot of people have a lot of buy-in because they want to come and learn how to do it as well. Back to doing it yourself. You want a lot of those guys want to learn just those little tips and tricks that can help you out in the long run with your bird dog. And then like coming in with a puppy, I know a lot of people, like Brock is a good one. He didn't want to make mistakes like he did with his first dog is what he's telling me. And just being able to be with the owner and teaching the owner as well as the dog. And then I'll run through a quick thing with the dog and then I'll have the owner go and do it. And so they're making that bond with the dog as well. And then I've seen good things from each dog that I've helped, and that dog and owner, I mean, usually are pretty successful during hunting season. A lot of those issues are, I feel like, taken care of. I mean, it's not really good job security for me, obviously, because I mean, usually the dog doesn't need to come back, but I make good friendships out of it. So they come back anyways to train with me and we go hunting and all that good stuff together. So,
I mean, did a buddy just call you up and say, hey, I need some help with some things, and this is kind of how it got kickstarted for you? Or was it more intentional or planned?
Exactly. Yeah. So I've had a couple, once I started getting pigeons, and into that, the pigeon side of things, I had a bunch of buddies that were like, hey, can I come out and train with you? You've got birds. And I was like, yeah, come on out. And then I'm from Utah, so I have a lot of people on the Utah Facebook pages asking for help. So I'll just hop on there and tell them to message me and we work something out and go from there. So
it's always funny when you start getting the resources, the land, the equipment, the launchers, the pigeons, all of a sudden everybody's, you know, willing to ask for help and show up for sure. I can relate to a lot of that myself.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You, a lot of friends come out of the woodwork. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's important for, you know, combining resources and not just equipment and bird access and stuff like that, but the knowledge, you know, everybody kind of learns at a different pace and different ways. And that's why I enjoy having people come down, because I'll learn just as much from them and how they do things, or have tried or maybe failed or succeeded, whatever. I'm always learning something from them. Every time I get to help somebody, it's also kind of selfishly helping myself in the long run. That's how I try to look at it anyway.
Agree. And I can agree 100% more with that. Like I'm a mediocre dog trainer at best. I can get a dog to stand steady on point until you get there and shoot the bird. But watching a ton of other dogs and I've got a bunch of buddies that have hunted way longer and trained dogs way more than me. And even with some of those new handlers, I learned so much just from watching their dog and then just listening to their ideas. Like I'm the same way. It helps me out a ton. And so it can help me put it into my dogs as well. Just those little tips and tricks and ideas have helped me out in a long run too. So,
yeah. And I mean, you could say that that's kind of the, overarching benefit of any training group, whether that's affiliated with a specific organization or just a small group of buddies that consistently get together, is everybody kind of hits that acceleration button or the acceleration pedal, if you will, just by being able to combine your knowledge and resources. It makes it to where everybody kind of goes faster up that learning curve.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And as we all know, it can be a long learning curve, but when you have the right resources and stuff, it makes a lot more gradual. So you're not killing yourself or ramming your head into the wall, wondering what the heck's going on. So,
So, I mean, I'm curious, over the handful of years that you've been doing this, have you kind of seen a common thread or topic or hurdles that owners are having with their dogs specifically? I mean, I know that this can kind of be a can of worms here, and everybody has different issues with their own specific dogs. Everybody's different. Every dog's different. We all know that. But has there been something to where I've personally, I'll kind of just throw my two cents into this. When I'm talking to somebody, it seems like that they have a harder understanding or way of understanding some of the more advanced stuff, steadiness, force fetch, because they don't pay attention to the foundations as much, the stuff, the day-to-day stuff inside the house, the obedience, all that stuff. It's like they don't really connect the dots on just how important that is, that kind of bleeds over into everything else that we want to teach the dogs in the long run. I'm curious to get your take. If you're working with somebody one-on-one with their dogs, are you kind of seeing the same thing I am?
100%. Yeah. So, I mean, that the foundation, I think a lot of people look over that foundation of just obedience. I mean, obedience is key to most of the dog training side of things, I feel like. But yeah, a lot of people come into it as wanting their dog to be steady. They want it to be able to, the dog to be able to range out steady, hold birds for them. And I'm like, okay, let's go on a walk just like down the dirt road. And I mean, give me the handheld. And I want to just see how the dog listens to you. I want to see recall. I want to see, I mean, I'll have dummies. I'll have birds. I just want to see like how that dog acts with you not being able to hold that handheld. I know that handheld can become a crutch during training season and all that stuff. And a lot of the times it boils down just to that, the obedience side of things, to where, I mean, if we can get that obedience dialed in, we can then build off that foundation. Because, I mean, if your foundation isn't strong, you're going to start seeing a lot of holes as you try to build that pyramid up to where you want to be. Yeah. So,
and to me, troubleshooting, you know, it always goes back to let's back up. Let's break this down to like the smallest incremental steps that we possibly can. Where did that disconnect happen? The dog understands whoa at the food bowl, but it has no idea what whoa means in the field and confronted with birds. Where did we kind of lose that connection, if you will? And it's funny when you start breaking that down, when you're kind of asking the people questions of like, well, how did you overlay this? How did you transition to that? It's always kind of lost in the translation. And it blows my mind. We can talk about this on the podcast week in, week out, but until there's just something about being face to face with somebody with their dog mm-hmm. right in front of you, to where it, then all of a sudden you kind of see the light bulb click and they're like, oh, okay, oh, now yeah. I get it. That stuff inside the house that, you know, 24/7 matters just as much, if not more, than out here.
100%. Yeah, I love when I'm with the client as well as the dog and being like, okay, let's try this out. And then I'm pointing out like little things, just like watching their ears, watching their tail, panting, all that stuff. And as I'm pointing it out to the owner, they're like, oh, like, I mean, you can read a lot from a dog just by, I mean, obviously just looking at the dog as it's working. And so like helping them just to see those little teeny things, I feel like can help them out in their house and all of that stuff as well. And then, I mean, I love doing a full training and then sending the client home with some homework just work whoa or work certain different things. And then we'll come back in a week and see what it looks like. And you can tell real quick if they worked that with their dog that week, or if they are lying to you and said they worked it with their dog.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You can't plagiarize that, you know, that homework. It's either there, it was either done or it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. That the dog's not going to lie to you, but the owners, I mean, I'm pretty good at it too. We like to talk the dogs up and say, oh yeah, they can do it good. And then it all goes downhill from there usually. So I know that from personal experience.
Yeah, so. I tell everybody whether it's intended or not, the dogs are always the truth tellers. And
100%.
You know, it's that the truth is going to come out, whether it's embarrassing or conversely. You know, I'm kind of guilty of, I kind of err on the side of saying my dogs aren't aren't consistent, or you can't really count on them to do something a certain way consistently, and then they go out and they do everything perfectly. And I'm just standing there like, it was a good day, and everybody's looking at me like, you said they didn't know any of this. I'm like, yesterday they didn't, but
100%.
Yeah. I always try and keep that expectation bar lower, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if I'm with you, you want to keep it low. And the one time, as I mean, you've talked about in the podcast, and you hear from everyone, the one time you're like, oh yeah, my dog is going to be lights out. Like, he's going to go point that chucker, the covey of chucker, the covey of huns, or that blue grouse up in the mountains, and you go up there with that person you told that to, and guess what? Your dog's ripping every covey. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, yesterday he was holding for me. I mean, everyone does it. And I mean, I'll still say it every once in a while. Then I'm like, oh crap, here it goes. Yeah. It's going to go downhill.
And then you're going to start hearing the whole, my dog's never done that. And it goes into that saying, you know, if you say your dog's never done something, then they're going to go out and do the thing that they've never done. Never, ever, ever. It's like, I can't ever get the saying right, but yeah, it's,
I know the thing you're saying, and I'm with you.
Another kind of consistent factor, and this is kind of where you and I connected a while ago, prior to me even knowing that you're kind of doing one-on-one sessions and dipping your toe in the training field, if you will. The common thread between us that we connected on was we train dogs to go hunt, right? Like, that's our 100%. Primary goal. And it's very interesting to me and intriguing on what brings everybody to this world, and not everybody comes into this dog world wanting to go hunt, or at least as passionate of a hunters as we like to think of ourselves. But some people truly just, they get a dog, they need an outlet, and you know, they got a sporting breed, they didn't really fully understand what they're getting into, now they need that outlet, so they just need to train to essentially be able to live in peace with that dog inside the house. Then you have some people that truly just appreciate the games, the trials, the test, and stuff like that. And maybe they do an occasional hunt. Then there's some people that just, you know, they do it. And if they go do a preserve hunt around the holidays with their family, that's all they're in it for. But when you're helping so many people, they come to you for asking, I'm having issues with X, Y, and Z. You start asking them, well, what's your end goal here? You know, it's, if somebody's having trouble with steadiness, you're talking to them and they're like, man, I just can't get my dog to stay steady on this. And you're, well, what's your end goal? Well, I just want to go shoot birds. I'm like, well, your dog's holding point just fine. What level of steadiness do you need to get to? Having clear and concise goals, kind of, if that's lacking, it's hard for a lot of people to understand what level they're supposed to be training up to. And a lot of people kind of put a certain level of unnecessary burden on themselves and their dogs because they don't have any intention of, you know, becoming the NAVDA versatile champion, but yet they're trying to steady their dogs up to that degree because social media, you know, makes them think that they need to. So when you're talking to people one-on-one, I'm assuming the goal conversation comes up just as quickly on your end as it does mine when I'm helping somebody.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. The goals are, I mean, back to what you said is, like, goals are a big, big thing. Everyone wants their dog to stand steady on point. I mean, if you have a pointing dog, that's obviously your goal there. And then you want that attainable goal too, where people are scrolling through social media every day, seeing these, broke field trial dogs or something like that, that are going on point, they're shooting birds and the dog's still standing there. And I think a lot of those, I mean, it takes a lot of work to get to those points, but just being able to have that goal and an attainable goal to where most of these people that I'm helping, their dogs will run out and go on point, and it will stand there for, I mean, a good while, and I mean, have all these different things thrown at it when they're on point. And in my head, I'm like, okay, well, I need to dig down a little bit more deeper on the goal and why they want the dog standing there, broke to steady, wing shot, flush, like all that stuff. And so usually, yeah, the goal is a big key part, but it's also got to be, I mean, we've all heard it wants to be an attainable to where we're not trying to push it out so far. I mean, I hold my dogs to a very, very high standard. And honestly, most of the time they're not at that standard, because during hunting season I don't want to go train and I want to go hunt birds. But I like to keep it for me. I like to keep that high standard so that we can. I mean, it gives me something to work for. But the everyday person, I mean, just a dog that's going to stand to flush, to where you can shoot a bird. I mean, and it's different for everyone, obviously, but like it perfectly fine, and that's a perfectly goal to have. I mean,
well, and so it's funny when you say, because I kind of put myself in the same group as you, to where I will say that I have high standards for my dogs. But what amazes me is how many people don't have any standards for their dogs.
100%.
And that's really, like, I'm a pretty open-minded guy when it comes to dogs and what people, you know, individuals want to do with their specific dogs. I'm pretty open-minded in that. Whatever floats your boat, go for it. I have a disconnect with certain people that will spend their entire year and years plus training their dogs up to a certain level in the off season, and then the first walk out of the truck, be it on the prairie and the rough grouse woods, whatever, everything you work for goes out the window. And then they're starting over from scratch. Essentially, it comes springtime. I have a hard time relating and understanding that. And it goes back into the goals. It's just, you know, again, it's your dog, hunt however you want to hunt. I'm not going to judge you on that, but you know what? It's like, we just spent all last summer together trying getting your dog up to a certain level, just for you to watch it go floating out the window as soon as you go out there and try and actually apply it in real world hunting scenarios.
100%. The dogs aren't dumb. I mean, they totally understand, like, okay, we're training, so they're going to stand 100% steady. And then, if I go out when I'm out in the woods hunting rough grouse or something, if I pressure it and maybe bump the bird, the guy's still going to shoot the bird for me. So it's like, if you're working to super steady during training season, and then you go and they bump one bird or rip a bird and you shoot it, well, there goes a lot of that training. I mean, you can get them back, but I mean, like you said, you're going next summer, you're going back to scratch, having to build that all up again. When watching a couple birds fly away at the start of the season is going to really help you out through the rest of the season.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can give an actual example. I mean, just yesterday, so while I was up in the Northwoods in October, Rachel, my older short hair, she's been trained stop to flush for years, right? Out in Colorado, out in Idaho, she was fine. She was still doing what she's trained to do up to the level that I expected. We get in the rough grouse woods, where I can't necessarily see her or the bird, so it's hard for me to make an actual correction on whatever. But there were a couple instances to where I just saw her just completely ignore a wild flush. And I'm like, well, all right, I'm not going to fix this right here and now in the Northwoods. I'm obviously not shooting that bird. I'm not going to encourage it. But yesterday I come out and I do a setup here now that I'm at home, and I go set up a couple launcher equations and a couple covey birds and multiple birds. And I set it up to where the wind, you know, we're coming upwind. So she could not smell the birds, and I launch it and she's running full speed. And next thing you know, the bird gets up and she slams on the brake and her belly essentially just slides on the ground with her putting the brakes on. And I'm just sitting here like, I could not replicate her screwing it up as she was in the Northwoods with down here. And it kind of, to your point, these dogs are smart. They know when they're in a training setup, they know when they're in an actual hunting setup. And she knew in those grouse woods that I realistically could not see or know that she was not stopping to flush, if you will, because of all that dense cover. And, you know, it's just another testament to where we can't replicate everything that you come across in an actual hunting scenario. But, you know, and that's part of the trouble when we talk about training sessions. And so when somebody's like, are wild birds really that important? Yes, they are, because we can train something for years, and then you have your 8, 9, 10-year-old dog go out that's been doing it for almost the better part of a decade, and they're just all of a sudden puppies again and testing you, and it's just drives me insane.
Yeah. I have a 9-year-old Irish setter. His name is Nitro, and dude, that dog's a bird finding machine, and he's a dang good dog. But I can't hunt him anywhere that has hills to where I can't see him, because as soon as he breaks over the hill and he knows I can't see him, he'll rip the birds no matter what. If I'm hunting flat ground and I can see him, he'll stand there and look at, like, just, I mean, he's not the most stylish dog, but he'll stand there and hold point because he knows if I can see him, I'm gonna give him a little bit of electricity if he decides to go in. But I mean, he's a smart dog, and I mean, he's a funny one, but man, it's like, dude, just stand there for me.
Well, it's those smart ones that drive us insane. Those are the ones that we want, because we want intelligent dogs. We don't want dogs that just kind of, you know, there's nothing going on behind the eyes and they're just running until they run into scent.
We want a robot.
Yeah, we want those dogs that can start piecing together the puzzle and start hitting objectives and stuff like that. And so you said you have an Irish setter. What, list off all the dogs and what kind of dogs you run and all that stuff.
So right now I'm only running two dogs. I've got a 9-year-old, 8 or 9-year-old Irish setter. His name's Nitro. And then I've got a 2-year-old English pointer. And that dog, all he knows how to do is run and sleep and point birds. He's absolutely insane. But I mean, he's one of those dogs that you put him on the ground, he's gonna go out and find birds. I mean, he covers a ton of ground. He's a big, big running dog. But I mean, I've had a lot of bad luck with dogs in the past, and so I've had my fair share of dogs, and just have, I mean, whether it be cancer or something comes up. So I've been through my fair share. And right now, these are the ones I'm sticking with, and then probably more English pointers in the future. So,
all right. So the English pointer bug bit you, and so far with the 2-3-year-old, you're enjoying that high octane lifestyle, huh?
Oh yeah, dude. I'm all about it. And high octane is, is a easy way to put it with him. So,
what is it about the high octane? Because especially, again, going back to you working 1-on-1, so many of the people that get into this world both live within the house with their dogs now, and they go hunt. So the high octane type dogs, the one that just has the jet fuel just oozing out of their ears, you know, those kind of dogs are kind of, they're not going by the wayside, because there's people such as yourself that's what they, you know, that's what sets their teeth on edge. You know, kind of put it into words, why you have a preference for that style dog, because hunting season is only a portion of the year, and the rest of the year we're living with them. So how is he in the house? You know, is this a term of training, or is it just the high energy dogs are going to be high energy, whether they're in the house or not, and you focus on the training or not?
Yep, for sure. So, I mean, English pointers definitely get a bad rap at being, I mean, crazy, no matter where they're at. From all my experience, I've been around a good handful of them, and when you get them in the house, they have, most of them that I've seen, as long as you go like with the good breeding and obviously everything that route. I mean, I can't get my English pointer off the couch when I'm at my house. I have to like drag him off the couch to make him go outside to go to the bathroom. I mean, he would lay there and not have to move for 12 hours if I would just let him. And then, I mean, we go outside to throw him in the kennel, and he knows it's game on, and he'll just go forever. But yeah, obviously a lot of it has to do with that the breeding, but most English pointers I've seen are very, obviously, there was a reason they get that rap, very crazy in the field. And then they come home and they're kind of like a little cat. They don't want you to touch them. They are very loving dogs, but he has his spot, and that's his spot. And like, he'll curl up in the little ball. And I mean, he doesn't want anybody taking his spot. And if you're in his spot, he's going to come push you out of it until that's his spot on the couch. And then, he just wants to lay there in the heat and not move until it's time to go run 300 miles or whatever he does. So,
well, that's funny. And I can kind of see a lot of that within my little English setter. You know, she's just a little over year old now. And I would classify her in the field for sure as a little bit more high octane compared to my German dogs. But inside the house, that off switch, man, when she lays down, I swear there's been days that like you have to drag her outside. Like once she decides it's nap time, she's she's out. You can go kick her. You can dump her off the pillow. And she just kind of looks at you like, what? Like, this is nap time. What are you doing?
100%. I have three kids, a 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and a 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and a 6-month-old. And I mean, those dogs are, I mean, my 4-year-old thinks they're horses half the time and needs to jump and sit on them and all this stuff. And so, I mean, they get beat up at the house. So they're pretty good at sleeping through it just like that. I mean, you have to like shake them a little bit to wake them up because they're so used to getting their ears pulled or something like that throughout the day. So,
right. So when you have a dog like an English Pointer, like you said, they're just ready to go 300 miles at a time. And somebody doesn't get a dog like that, that doesn't want to go chase birds. And again, back to my previous point, that's where you and I connected a long time ago, was talking bird hunting. And I think we spoke like last spring. You were telling me that some of the plans and hunts that you had coming up this fall. I'm curious, what were some of the destination and plans that actually came to fruition for you? Because we talk, you know, springtime, like, I'm going to do this, and that, and come fall. And then inevitably life gets in the way. So what are some of the trips and species that you've been hunting so far this season?
For sure. So fortunately I've got a job that I can take a lot of time off, which makes it nice for the hunting season, so I can make a lot of those dreams and fruitions come to place. To start out the season, I went up to Wyoming and hunted sage grouse up there. I mean, we got into a ton of birds. That was a blast. I brought both my dogs up there, and it was the first time my pointer's ever been on. He's 2 years old, so his second season going into it. So first time he's ever been on sage grouse. And my goal this year with him was just to get into as many birds as possible and as many species and all that stuff. So we went up there, had a blast up there, and then Idaho opened up, and I hit Idaho. I'm about 2 hours from some good places that I go to up in Idaho, and I'm up there probably one or two times a week, probably just running on hun. I have the hun bug has caught me lately, and so I've been running a bunch on those, and I mean Sharpies, all that good stuff. And then the big trip was up to Canada. I got a couple buddies up there, and so I made that 12-hour journey through the border and all that to a little town just south of Lethbridge, Alberta, to Raymond, Alberta. There's just a handful of birds up there. I can say that for a fact. And then a couple other of my goals. I wanted to hit Montana on the way back through, but the dogs after Canada were beat. I mean, my English Pointer put on 167 miles in like 3 days. And so he was pretty toast on the way home. So I was tired. I mean, everyone was tired. I had my 4-year-old boy with me, as well as my dad came up with me up there. And I mean, we at that point, we're just like, okay, let's just get home. I mean, we're tired. And then, still, I'm going to be hitting Nevada here in a couple of weeks. And then January, we have a trip down to Arizona that is still in the planning stages, but to go hunt the quail species down there and see what we can turn up. Yeah. So.
Well, you say you got bit by the hun bug specifically this year. I know in years past you've hunted them, but this is a great year to get bit by that bug. I know huns kind of exploded everywhere from my understanding. You know, I saw them in a few spots myself, especially in Idaho, and Idaho was something special, but Canada, that's something on my list. You know, that's something every year I kick around the idea. I toy with it a little bit in the springtime. Like, I would love to kind of shoot up into Canada and experience that for what it is. But it just never really comes to light, mainly because there's so many opportunities across the U.S. that I can kind of justify. I can plan them a lot easier, to where Canada, I know that there's a lot of stuff that I don't know on what to do and how to cross the border and all that stuff. So I figure I'm saving that for at some point down the road. But what is some of the hurdles or checklist items that you need to go effectively hunt Canada, to where you're not crossing the border and kicking off your trip with some headaches and maybe some legal troubles?
Oh, for sure. And we've all heard stories of people that have gone to Canada and they cross the border and they are getting their truck ripped to pieces and their dog boxes and everything taken apart just to see what's going on. The one big thing, if you're bringing dogs across, I've never been asked, but they always say they want the shot records and everything. The main shot records, they want like the rabies shots, the main one. So that's always a good one to keep in your little folder as you're crossing the border. Most of the time, like I said, I've never been asked. I know people who have been asked. So that's a good one to have. And then if you're bringing guns across, that's also a hurdle that can be, it can be a big hurdle. And that's the one where when I was crossing the border this year, I don't know why, but I like to go in it as like, okay, my truck's gonna get ripped apart. Just thinking the worst, a gun declaration form that you need to fill out. And once you get to the border, they're going to be, you obviously declare your gun. And then you have to walk inside and pay a $25 fee. Just like a gun permit as you're up there. It's actually really, really simple. The big thing I see people, they like to go up there and they start asking questions. Just when you're crossing the border, keep your mouth shut, answer their questions. Don't ask questions, just drive through. It's going to make your life a lot easier.
See, that would be my problem right there is I'm so naturally curious about everything. I would want to ask, be like, well, why do you want that? Completely innocent. Not 100%. Like probing to prove a point or anything, or be like, yep. Oh yeah, we have it figured out now, you know, in the US and you guys don't. But I am such a naturally curious person, lends itself in my favor in certain regards, such as maybe this podcast, but in a situation such as that is to where you just want to keep your mouth shut and keep on moving. Would be very hard for me not to ask some of the questions that would pop up in my head as to, you know, well, why do I need to fill this out on the gun declaration page, right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm with you. I had a lot of those questions, like just going across, like why do I need to do this? I even went to the point, like I said, I had my 4-year-old boy with me. And when you're a man and with no, like your wife isn't with you going up with a kid, like I even had my wife write out a letter saying it's all right that I'm taking my kid across the border with me.
Nice.
I'm like, the last thing I want to do is get to the border an hour and a half away from where I need to go and then have to turn around and go back.
Right.
And so like, the way I look at it is, obviously like a lot of the stuff they make you do is kind of dumb, but dot all your I's, cross all your T's, like get everything figured out. And like I said, it is actually very simple to get across the border. They definitely make it, and it's something to where it could totally ruin your trip. A 10-minute pull into the border can cause you to turn around and drive another 10 hours back home or however long it takes you. But yeah, the main thing, don't ask any questions. Like you can ask questions, obviously, but don't
prolong.
You got to look at, they're dealing with some real, some people that are not nice, or they're asking tons of questions. And these guys are, obviously they're trying to protect their country probably to get, so people aren't going in and out with stuff that shouldn't be going in and out of the country. But yeah, it definitely was just an eye opener for me. Like when I was going across, we went in and my buddy was like, just go through, answer their questions. Don't ask anything. If you need something, ask me and I'll help you out. But we went in to pay our $25 fee, and there was a lady in there asking questions about guns, money, all this stuff that, I don't even work at the border, and it was throwing red flags to me. And so I was like, it makes sense now why my buddy was saying, just go with the flow, go across the border. And then we went, and another big one was, there's obviously like the I-15 is a big freeway that goes all the way up to the border, and it's a big border crossing. I made a 30-minute loop out of the way to go to a much smaller border crossing. So you're not dealing with a bunch of people. It's just nice and quick, makes it real simple. And so you're not dealing with overly stressed or worked people, all that good stuff. And so it was smooth, but it can, like I was saying earlier, it can definitely put a a road bump in your journey. So
yeah, sounds like everything else in life though. If, as long as you do your due diligence, you're kind of prepared, you keep your mouth shut, you know, generally you can kind of float on by without too big of a headache. Yep. And you know, stupid stuff happens all the time. But once you get across the border, you know, obviously it sounds like there really wasn't anything too alarming or unexpected that happened to you at the border. What is it like once you get over there? You know, what's the hunting license process and prices and stuff like that compared to down here in the U.S.? You know, just talk to me what it's like about getting everything set up for you to actually go hunt in Canada.
So first of all, if you're driving through, everything is in kilometers. So it really throws you off when you're used to
going
80 miles an hour on the road and then you're into kilometers. And it's like I would always look down at my speedometer as I had to switch it to kilometers or else I was going to be going way too fast. Because it's like 100 miles an hour, which is like 60 kilometers or something in that ballpark.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, 100 kilometers an hour is like 60 miles an hour. So that one threw me off a little bit, but I was like, okay, well, that's an easy one to take in. A lot of and this is different for each, what is it up there? I don't want to say states, but each, like Alberta, Saskatchewan, all those they all have different prices, different policies, all that kind of stuff, rules, as long as the hunting goes along. But in Alberta, you're pushing just to hunt upland birds. I mean, coming from out of the country, you're right around that $200-$300 mark once you get all your licenses and everything in place. And then if you're looking to hunt ducks, which if you're going up there, if you're at the right time, I would highly suggest it. It is insane.
I heard it'll spoil you. You never want to go hunt ducks again south of the border.
Yeah, I'm not, like I said, I'm from Utah, and I saw more birds in a 20-minute sit than I'd probably see all year in Utah. It was insane, just the amount of birds that we were seeing. But that thing, the your duck license, your duck stamps, probably like, I think, another 30 or 40 bucks. So it's honestly not that expensive. I mean, looking at places, we could throw Idaho out there, you're spending $170 just for a year's license. And then if you buy a sharp tail or like a sage grouse tag on top of that, you're pushing $200, $250 in that ballpark. So you're about the same price. But it's just getting across the border and all that stuff that can add up to it. But yeah, the duck hunting, like I was saying, we made one sit up there. We sat down, and before we were even setting the decoys out, we had ducks coming in, and it was crazy. And I have some of the videos are on my Instagram, but it's almost like a shooting gallery, just because I've never I haven't done it a ton like that. But you sit up and you have 100 mallards freaking flying right in front of you. So it's when you sit up, it's difficult to, the first couple times, just like picking out a bird, like kind of like you're hunting a covey of huns or chucker, picking out that bird. But after two or three of the birds working the spread and everything, you started putting it together. But yeah, we shot our 4-man limit in, I think it was just over 15 minutes of 32 ducks. It was a lot of birds coming in all at once, but it was crazy.
In regards to, overall, does anything kind of at the top of your head come off as something that's like a stark difference from down here, whether it's bag limits, shooting hours, or just anything like that, you know, something that, you know, we have it down pat down here. We kind of know what you can and can't do down here. What's a big difference up there? You know, is there any kind of non-tox requirement on ammo up there as opposed to down here where it's really just kind of catching on state by state? You know, just talk to me overall what stands out to you in terms of differences.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good question. So jumping on that non-tox. So it's, you can shoot lead for any upland bird, obviously, unless you're like on a, like their waterfowl management areas. Onyx isn't working up there right now too, so that was a big difference for me, just being able to, I know their Onyx is working on it up there, but just being able to like know where you're at was very difficult. Canada has their own apps that you can get on and know where the public land is as well as private land.
So Onyx, but up in Canada, do they have a version of Onyx up there, or are they working on the actual launch of Canada
so,
up there?
So from, I just know from my experience, I'm not sure, like, I know, listen to a couple other podcasts. I know they're working on it up there, but they don't have like the, just the landowners or anything. So they don't have really any land, like, so you don't know who owns this or who owns this. And so, and then everything up there is in the square. It's like by a 1 mile by 2 mile square is all the sections. And so like down here in the States, a lot of times, I mean, the boundaries are all just crazy. I mean,
somebody gave a 3-year-old a crayon, said, draw out my property boundaries down here in the U.S.
It is insane. So that's the nice thing about up there is, I mean, I didn't have the app they had, but my buddy's like, okay, you can hunt this section. You have 3 miles east to west and 6 miles north to south. So I'm like, okay. So it made, I mean, obviously I'm not going to work that much in a couple hours, but it just made me know, okay, I'm good crossing this fence or I'm good crossing that fence. So that was a big difference. And that was difficult for me just because I'm like, in the United States with Onyx, I mean, I know right where I'm at all times. I mean, so I know I'm not crossing into a private land. I mean, there's a lot of public land in like Utah where I hunt, or Idaho. And so it makes it to where it's easy to know where you're at. Up there, they have a lot of public sections, but a lot of it is all like just private. And the one thing about what I've experienced from Alberta, I had a buddy up there, but when you can go ask permission, and those people are very willing to let you come up. I mean, they think you're crazy that you want to go hunt those little gray birds that are eating all their grain and sorghum and all that stuff. But they're super nice. And you tell them like just the story of like how you've gotten up here and everything. And they're really willing to let you up as far as like every hunt their land. But as far as everything else, I mean, bag limits, it was five Hungarian partridges, 5 sharptail a day, which was quite a bit compared to some other places. Mm-hmm. And then 2 pheasants every day to the upland side.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the only birds, like that's all we saw up there. And I mean, the hun numbers up there were ridiculous.
That's kind of surprising that the limit would just be at 5 with as many birds on the landscape. Exactly. And the locals kind of looking at you kind of crazy on, you really want to hunt them? You would think that they'd try to incentivize hunters for hunting.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think the bird numbers are so good up there? Describe the habitat. You mentioned the ag, which we know it, or the listeners, if you're unfamiliar, like huns are one of those. They don't obviously live within the ag, but they're adjacent to it in some regard. So is it kind of the same game up there as you would do down here in the U.S. to where if you can find those little strips of native grasses in between, maybe some fence rows or shelter belts between like ag fields, is that pretty much what you're targeting up there?
Yep. So the ag fields, I mean, if you could stand up 100 miles in the air, it's just ag fields for as long as you can see. And the cool thing is a lot of the areas right along those fence lines, I mean, they're leaving a good little belt of grass so that the birds can work in, work out. They also have, I don't know, it's a shrub plant of some sort. I've heard it on a podcast before this, and I can't remember the name now, but it's a plant that they planted along those like fence lines just to make it like a shelter belt, just to where I know back in the day they're having a really drought year. And so it's just helping keep the land and everything in place. Yep.
Oh, so for erosion control, they planted
erosion control. Yep.
I wonder what that is. What is it? Maybe like rose hips or something like that. Some plum thickets, maybe beauty berries. Yeah,
it looked a lot like that. I can't remember. Cannot remember the name of it to save my life right now. I was thinking about it just a minute ago.
You'll think of it as soon as we turn off the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, I will. I know 100%. But that helped. I always saw Sharpies as well as Huns in that area, just because it gave them that cover overhead a lot of times. But, and then there's a ton of coulees up there. Like, I mean, you're working the ag fields and then it all drops down these fingers, and then you have coulees going through the middle of your, of the ag fields. And so you're down in the bottom of those coulees, you're in those like willow thickets and streams. So you're busting pheasants up through the bottom and then working up the side, and you're hitting huns as well as Sharpies going up onto the top. And then you have a big running dog, they're out 5 miles into the ag field point and just a random covey of huns that are sitting a mile away from anything.
So this was September or early October?
Oh, man, you're going to make me think. Now, I think it was September.
So early season, you're up there just doing a mixed bag shoot of huns, sharp tails, pheasant, and then, you know, getting your crazy 20-minute limit of ducks real quick in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. So
did you get any sleep?
Not much. Yeah, we hunted all day. And I mean, like I said, we definitely had to work to find the birds. Like the huns were there, the pheasants were there, the sharpies. I mean, there's good numbers, but just being able to get them locked down and stuff with a 2-year-old dog, he has not been able to figure out sharpies yet.
Okay.
So we bumped, I would say ripped a lot of sharpies, which I went up there just for a learning experience for him as well. But yeah, we saw, like I said, a ton of birds. And my buddy owns a big waterfowl outfit, and so they're looking into opening up the upland side up there as well. So the main reason I went there is just to kind of get a good feel of what it looks like for that, as well as, I mean, Canada's awesome, and just knowing where, like, getting a good feel of the whole landscape. But the whole landscape is a lot like hunting Montana, or I mean, some parts of Idaho, just hunting that nice rolling hills, ag land for as far as you can see. I mean, canola fields and wheat and all that stuff. So perfect for the birds. And I mean, you could see that a lot of the people, I mean, liked that, having the birds on their landscapes. I mean, some people were saying that they were leaving those. I mean, they're not cutting that extra right up to the fence line because they wanted to keep some stuff for the birds there. They liked to see them as they were working their fields and all that stuff.
Well, you said some of the locals were kind of questioning why, maybe your motives of chasing these little crazy gray ag birds, if you will. But
yeah,
what was their overall, were they really receptive? Were they really excited to have kind of hunters in the area? You know, talk to me about the kind of the local outlook on it, because even some areas in the U.S. you go and maybe some of the locals don't really fully appreciate or very excited to have hunters in there. And then some places you go and it's like you can tell real quick the local economies, like who really benefits from hunters traveling in and the local economies that don't. What was kind of impressions of that in Canada?
For sure. So a lot of the time, I mean, when I said I was wanting to hunt your land, and then I told them I was from the United States down in Utah, they always took them back, because they have a ton of people coming from BC, the British Columbia, come over to hunt. And I talked to a couple owners up there, and they're like, oh, those BC people need to stay over there and all this stuff. But they're like, but since you're from the States, yeah, go for it.
So and Americans welcome, BC guys not. Got it.
Yeah, and I got that from a couple, and I just started laughing. But yeah, going with that, I mean, we had a lot of people let us in just because we were from, I mean, the States, and we drove this far, you might as well go and hunt them anyways, and all that stuff. And like my friend up there, he thinks we're crazy to want to go and hunt those birds as well, because I mean, he puts in a ton of work scouting for waterfowl, making sure he's got, I mean, just getting a ton of birds, knowing right where they're at. So when he has clients coming up, he can have an amazing 3-day hunt. But he would come back every day shooting a limit of huns just off the side of the road. And he's like, why are you guys going and asking people to hunt? Or why are you running dogs when you can just drive the road and shoot them? And I'm like, he doesn't have a ton or like the same love I have for it with just watching the dogs.
Well, and that's eerily similar to a lot of the areas in the U.S. I mean, there's
100%.
There's road hunters in kind of like every bird heavy region that they don't comprehend what we're out there doing. Like we're in it more for the experience and the dog work than we are just to bag a bunch of birds and go have dinner. Right. It's just
it's a different thing. I limited on pheasants a couple of times up there, but like, I'm not out there to shoot my limit. Like I didn't shoot a limit of huns. I didn't shoot a limit of sharpies. But I mean, I had my chances, but I love chasing the dog and everything like that. And I mean, the landowners and everything, Thought it was cool that we had our own dogs up there and all that stuff, and just out chasing birds that they see every day, and they're like, oh, whatever.
Yeah. So. Well, it sounds like, you know, getting to know you a little bit, there's a couple staples of locations and regions that you look forward to hunting every single year. I'm curious if Canada is going to be added to that list of maybe annual check-ins, or just that's something once in a blue moon you're going to go do on occasion.
You know, I would love to make it an annual trip. It costs a lot of money to get up there, so it's probably going to turn into every other year kind of thing. Just depending on, I mean, gas prices and all that stuff. If I can get up there every year, I'd go up there every year. But I mean, when I can drive the same amount of time and go hunt like Montana or something up in that region, and I don't have to cross the border and go through that craziness, and I'm still hunting flat ground compared to like Utah, right. I'm all about it. So yeah. As long as I'm hunting birds, Canada's awesome just because it's a different country. You're able to, I mean, it's just totally different.
Yeah, so, man. I mean, you know, you get to play the international uplander. I mean, it's like
100%.
It's just something cool. And I mean, at the end of the day, like once it's done, like, was it life changing in that, you know, just by that one experience? You know, probably not. But the fact that now you've had the experience and you have somewhat of a knowledge base of what it's like to go hunt international and what that implies, and it's just a cool experience. And I mean,
oh yeah,
coming from anybody that's listened to this for a while, they understand that, like, every year I try to go into a new place, a new location, new region, hunt some new birds, just because we all love what we come to love, you know, to do, right? Like, we all have our little annual checklist, if you will. But to me, like, I can't really fully say that, like, let's just call rough grouse hunting is my favorite passion. I mean, currently it is, but I'm not comfortable saying that, like, in the long run, that's going to be my number one choice forever, because I haven't experienced it all. And I don't know if I ever will, but it's just, I feel like there's always something better around the next corner, and whether it actually shows up or not, we'll see. But that's just part of the fun, is getting out and trying new things in new areas.
Oh yeah, I agree. And I mean, and just experiencing new birds, and I mean, every year is different too. That's one thing. Like this year, the huns are amazing. Chucker coveys that I've seen are amazing. Next year it could be, I mean, you're where like I've hunted in Idaho. I mean, we pushed over 200 birds the other day, and I could go up next year and find one covey of like 20 huns.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing where it's ever changing, but it also, I mean, it makes it a lot of fun to be able to, like, okay, I haven't experienced it all. Like, I've never hunted rough grouse out in like in Michigan or in the Northwoods or anything like that. And I would love to experience it. Hunted them in Utah, but I mean, just be able to get that full understanding and like, okay, like it, and like I said, it's changing every day and every year.
So. Yeah. I mean, every year the weather conditions and nesting conditions are always different, and there's a reason why. And every bird is different in what they thrive in, right? So the weather conditions that might be detrimental for one species might be, you know, what the doctor wrote for them on another species. But when we talk about, you know, figuring out the staples, the locations that we want to hit up every single year, you know, you've mentioned a number of the states out west that are obviously staples for you. You've mentioned Idaho a number of times, Montana, Nevada, Utah, obviously. I'm not going to have you tell me exactly where or even which state it's in, but I got to get the story of, you mentioned something on the phone a long time ago, something called Chungaria.
Yeah, good old Chungaria.
Chungaria. Yep. So, tell me the story behind Chungaria. What kind of was deserving of the name? Like, what was so special about it? Because you could tell, like, when you started talking about that, your voice really lit up, and I'm assuming that it's one of those, you know, dude, king of the honey holes, if you will.
Dude, it's one of those spots. I mean, king of the honey holes is a good way to put it. I have a good friend that lives up in that area, and he's like, dude, you gotta try this spot out. He's like, I've heard from some of my friends that it's a good spot. I was actually up there for work, and I brought my dog with me, so I was like, oh, well, like, might as well go try it. And dude, the first time I hunted it, like, it's flat ground, and I am busting, I mean, I don't even know how many coveys the first time. It was probably 12 or 13, and like a 3 mile walk of coveys and huns and chucker, and they're intermixed. So I mean, the first covey I doubled on, and I shot chucker and a hun out of the same covey, and I was like, what the heck? Like, I've never seen that. And first of all, like, I mean, you're kind of up on a little plateau area, so it's like, okay, like, I can see the chucker on the edges, but not right in the middle of where I'm at. I mean, I'm 600-700 yards from each like little cliff edge.
So they're literally hanging out in those little flats.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can get into them along the edges, but why go up and down when they're on the flat spot?
Right.
I mean, like, and so like, yeah, the first time I hunted it, it was, I only shot those two birds because I think I was more astonished with the amount of birds that, like, my dogs kept going on point, and I was like, my pointer kept going on point, and I was like, okay, well, here we go. And like, just the amount of birds that came up was like ridiculous. But yeah, it was good old Tringaria. It's a spot that I probably won't take very many people to because, I mean, it's close. It is very close to a couple cities. So I know other people know it, and I've seen other hunters up there, but.
It sounds like it might be one of those overlooked spots to where, you know, when you go somewhere, everybody pulls up the map and, oh, I don't want to hit that up, it's too close to the city. And really what ends up happening is everybody starts saying the same thing, and then nobody really goes out there to experience it. And so it's safe as a honey hole because everybody just keeps saying, oh, I need something bigger or further away from a populated area.
Oh, yeah. 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 And I mean, that's exactly what it is, I think. I mean, it's about 2-3 hours from my house, but it's worth the 2-3 hours. And I mean, like I said, it's right next to those cities where people are overlooking it just to, I mean, let's bounce. They're jumping to other places to find chuckers, huns, everything. And when it's all right up there on that little plateau.
So. Well, and that's really interesting because when you're describing this to me, when we spoke the first time is, you know, you hear about mixed bag opportunities. And so when somebody tells me like, oh yeah, you can find these, you know, multiple species on the same walk, I'm like, oh, that's cool. But it doesn't capture me like it once did when I first came in, because I've kind of been in this game long enough to where it's like, when somebody says you can run into this or that, you know, it's like, okay, it's a possibility, but yeah. I'm still only going to focus in on one target. And, you know, it was really interesting when I got out into Idaho, and I spoke on this on the episode a few weeks back, is when somebody was telling me that, no, this can happen or this is a possibility, they didn't really fully explain to me that it was a probability of running into where I thought, like, okay, chucker, huns, they might overlap. They might have some similar ranges here and there. But to your point, like, there were multiple times on a hillside to where we would kick up the, you know, a group of 40 chucker, and then 20 yards right behind that, kick up a group of 40. And so within, you know, 40, 50 yards, you're kicking up 80 to 100 birds. And, and it was just really eye-opening to where there is a reason why certain states just kind of refer to all of them as gray partridge, if you will, because, you know, I've always been curious, like, how can you count chucker the same thing as huns? And then you get out there and you see how close-knit they are. And let's be honest, you know, I'm fairly decent at picking out the types of birds on wing when they flush, like, oh, that's a pheasant, that's a sharp tail, whatever. Like, you get pretty proficient at that, especially depending on which direction the sun's at and how the coveys flush. It's almost impossible to pick out huns as opposed to chuckers, given the angle that they flush in sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're on like one of those steep hillsides. I mean, when you're holding them, they look totally different, but when they're flushing, I mean, they've both got like that gray back. Chucker are going to, from my experience, are going to be on a little bit of a bigger size than a hun.
Yeah, but not by much.
But not by much, not by much. I mean, the only really way to see the difference is like if they're flying by you, you can see the stripes of the chucker. And then, or if they're flying away, you can see the little like copper fan.
I was about to say the red fan of the hun and the stripes of the chucker, but
are the only ways. But at times, like you said, whether the sun's where the sun is, you can't see it. So it's just like, well, here we go.
Right. And it could be tough distinguishing the difference. I mean, I would say, given my, you know, I've been hunting, upland hunting, traveling, I don't know, 8-9 years, something like that. You hear all the time about, you know, sharp tails and hen pheasants get a lot of highlight when you start talking about birds that look eerily similar when they flush and know your target before you shoot. I'm going to go with Huns and Chukar are the hardest ones to distinguish in my book.
Yeah. And I mean, I see exactly where you're coming from on that. Cause I mean, they act pretty much the same on their flushes and all that stuff. So, I mean, obviously, like if you're standing right on top of them, you can tell, but if they're flushing from just a ways, it's like, okay, well, I'm shooting lead's going down range, but we'll, cause I mean, a lot of times it can be a group, like limit. I know in a couple places it's like, it's Chukar and then Huns are different limits. So you have to,
but really, some places, I mean, it's shared limits.
Yeah. The group, they have to just that limit to where, I mean, you can just throw lead down range. And if you shoot one, you shoot one,
right.
you get your five birds or whatever it is, and you're good.
Well, one thing that I'm finding interesting is the longer I hunt rough grouse and target them specifically, you know, they have overlapping habitat and environments with the woodcock. But the longer I target rough grouse, you can really start to pick covers and areas to hunt that kind of more or less avoid the woodcock, and you can hone in on grouse and vice versa if you're targeting woodcock. I'm curious, in your years of doing this, have you noticed a way to, if you wanted to get away from one or the other in those areas that they share in overlapping regions, have you figured out what kind of, if you want to only target Chukar and not shoot Huns or vice versa, have you noticed some common elements that might help you do so? Or is it just,
for sure,
or is it just really random?
And so, like, I mean, if you just want to target Huns, go down and hunt that ag land. Most of the time you're not going to see Chukar down in those flats. I think the only reason I'm seeing Chukar up on top is because there are those big cliff faces that they can go to. That's like, if you're just targeting Huns, ag lands. If you just want to target Chukar, I think that's a little harder because you're still going to find Huns in those steep, rocky canyons and everything like that. So, I mean, you're probably going to find more Chukar, but you're going to have Huns mixed in. And so, I mean, especially in those locations that have a ton of Chukar and a ton of Huns, if you just want to hunt Huns, hit the ag land. And if you just want to hunt Chukar, you're going to find Huns as well. So good luck.
Yeah. It seems like on the years that Hun numbers are good, they're just everywhere. I mean, they're just, yeah I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm the more I go out west and the more I get into Hun territory, the more I've come to appreciate them and love them even more. They're one of my favorite birds to hunt. They flush angry. They're fun to shoot. They're tough birds. I mean, I tell everybody, like, you know, I have a lot of faith in my dog's retrieving capabilities. They've proven it time and time again. But I'd say out of all the species we've been on, for whatever reason, Huns, I feel like I've lost a few birds here and there. Mm-hmm. Because you shoot them, you swear they're down, then you go over there and they're just gone. And
they're gone.
They've jumped down into whatever gopher snake hole is closest to them. And it's just, you know, you gotta be on them. If you shoot one and it goes down, you need to get to it fast regards to them.
Well, and they're small, so they can go down those little gopher holes and stuff if they need to. Like, it's, I mean, you can be hunting an ag field and watch it. You fold a bird and then you walk up to it and it's like, where the heck did it go? And obviously there's going to be those mouse and like bowl holes and everything, and they're nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
So,
well, talk to me real quick as we kind of start steering this ship into a landing. You know what?
For sure.
When you're going out and you're hunting Chukar and Huns, whether it's Chungaria or wherever else, dog style, you know, what do you prefer to see in your dogs? You know, talk to me about range, their capability. You know, what's the ideal dog for out west, in your opinion?
For sure. So my dog definitely does not fit everybody's cup of tea. I'm on the English Pointer side of things, and I can tell you right now, I love big running dogs. Now that has its pros and cons. Like, if I'm hunting Utah in those, like I'm hunting with mountain goats in some of the area there, it's brutal looking down at your Garmin and seeing that your dog is 700 yards on point over three canyons, and it makes it very painful.
Your legs are already burning just looking at the watch. Dude. Oh yeah.
So that, I mean, that's painful, but I also love having that big running dog. So if I'm hunting, like, say Utah again, working up one ridge, I know my pointer is working on that next ridge over. And so if he goes all the way up that ridge and there's no points, well, I don't have to worry about that side. And then he'll come over and work this right ridge and the next ridge over. So there's, it definitely helps. Okay, there's no birds on these three ridges. Let's circle up and go hit these other ones, because he'll work the ridge I'm on, the next ridge, and the next ridge over. And it's always that fourth or fifth ridge over that it's like, okay, crap. Now we're finding birds. but like I love so Chucker, I like him anywhere between 500 to 700. A lot of people say that's way too far. If you have a dog that's gonna hold steady and not pressure the birds, I mean it is what it is. The nice thing about having a dog that runs that big too is if they end up bumping the birds, you don't know about it, so you're good. So
right. ignorance is bliss in that instance.
100%. I don't know at that point. I see enough coveys of Chucker over him, or shoot at enough coveys of Chucker that I know he's holding most of the birds that he's finding. I mean, let's like back at Chungary, I was there a couple days ago, and I looked down at my Alpha, my Garmin Alpha, and it's in miles at that point. Like it's 0.6 miles away or something. And I'm like, oh, here we go. Like, so that to me is too far. And so I'll range him back. But like on that flat stuff, I'm good with him touching 1,000, 1,200. And then, I mean.
Now, in your experience, I know you know, you gave the context of if your dog is steady and will hold the birds and have the manners. In your experience, if you just had to, you know, just put an arbitrary percentage number of your dog goes a half a mile out, goes on point, and you got to get there, what's the percentage like of you getting there and the birds are actually still there?
So honestly, I mean, as you can imagine, the percentage is not very high. A lot of times, like if your dog's not going to overpressure them, the birds are going to just walk off the dog's point most of the time, or run off. And so I've worked a ton with like my pointer on just being able to track the birds. So, I mean, he's running out that far and I'm fine with it. And so I'll get up to him, and flat ground. I mean, it's 20, 30 minutes. I mean, if that, and so I'll release him. He'll track, and probably 100 yards, he's got him pinned again, which is fine with me. I mean, there are the times where you get there and there's no birds and it's like, well, that was the worst 1,000-yard sprint I've ever done in my life. and I mean, most of the time I've got my 4-year-old boy standing in my final rise pack. So I've got another 40 pounds sitting on my back that I'm trying to run with. But like I love those big running dogs, and I sweet spot, I would say anywhere from 600 to 800 yards is where I really like it. If he touches 1,000 or a little over 1,000, it's fine with me. I want my dog over 500 yards whenever I'm hunting with him. I mean, I did 12 miles on a couple days ago and my pointer did 63. So he did 5 times the amount of miles as me. This is all in one day, mind you. So, I mean, I have to watch him to make sure he's not going to kill himself. But you look on, like, I mean, you can get on and see the map where they've all gone. There's not a spot on that hilltop that wasn't covered or within a couple hundred yards. Like he's just, and that's one reason I love the big run dogs, is just they're covering so much more country compared to like my setter, who's a 300-400 yard dog.
And which that's a long ranging dog for the average person.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Which it is. It is. Yeah. I mean, he 300 is probably like 400 he'll hit every once in a while, but he's really 300 is his max. And I mean, he doesn't cover near the amount of, I mean, ground. And so, I mean, I find, and when I've been with a bunch of people, I mean, my pointer usually fine. And this is me talking my dog up again, so I'm gonna hate this in the future. But my pointer usually finds a majority of the birds, and I attribute that to he's just covering so much ground. I mean, so much more ground compared to these other dogs.
Yeah. Now, are you hunting your pointer with him getting so far out that kind of affords you the opportunity, if he's getting that far out, having that 300-yard dog like your Irish setter and closer to you. That's kind of a nice little combo to where I'm curious.
100%.
If he's that, if your pointer's that far out, how often is your cleanup dog finding and establishing contacts a little bit closer to you? And you know, are you trying to, I don't know, direct the Irish setter in a specific location, or are you just kind of following the English pointer and the path that he's taking?
So a lot of that times I'm just following the English pointer. I mean, I'll guide the closer dogs, whether it be my Irish setter, or I've got a buddy that runs a little German wire hair. I mean, we'll guide her in those closer areas just so as we can, as we're working, oh, there's a big patch of sagebrush. Let's go hit that really quick. I mean, there's been multiple times where we get a point notification, my pointer at 700 yards. And then, this little wire hair, my short hair, my setter, we'll go on point like 200 yards in front of us. So we'll go hit that covey and then we'll loop up and go hit the covey. And then, so we're getting dogs on point multiple places, which can turn into a little bit of a fiasco at times. But I mean, we're finding birds, and I like to look at it. If I'm not finding a covey a mile, I'm not hunting that place anymore. So, I've got a lot of places to where I can go. And I mean, I can do 6 miles and find 6 to 7 coveys. And so I'm like, I'll go hunt that. I love hunting different places to where, I mean, I've got a big run dog that I'll know within an hour if there's birds on the ground or not.
Right.
Or in the area. So.
Yeah. Now with a dog,
the close working dog is nice.
Yeah. Everything's a balancing act, you know. It's like kind of, again, going back to the Idaho bird camp episode that I did, you know, we talked about this a little bit in regards to, you know, my dogs, you know, they're definitely not that rangy, especially with what we do down here in the South and in the East and the North woods. Don't really establish that range. There's really not anywhere that I can take them to run them that far. They will open up over time if you hunt enough days in a row out west in the prairie. Sure. But you don't have to have that dog that ranges further. But to your point, a dog that ranges further, you're getting that feedback of, are the birds really in this area? To where I go back to, we hunted 3 days in Idaho, and the day in the middle, it was just one of those sucky days to where it's like you were just humping it and you didn't come away with anything. To where a dog like that, it might tell you a little bit sooner, hey, you can go back to the truck and go find a new area. This specific walk just isn't happening. But sure. But with the short ranging dog, it's like there's really only one way to know if there's birds up there on that ridge, and that's to take them up there.
Oh, yeah, 100%, 100%. And that's an English pointer, or you can get any English pointer that runs short or big, like small or big. But a big run dog definitely isn't for everybody. I like to look at myself as more of a little bit of a lazy hunter, and I don't want to go walk down every ravine and up every valley and up and down and up and down when my dog, like I said, my dog's going to cover it. So I don't need to hunt those two ridges because my dog, and like I can look on my little map on my Garmin, like, okay, he's already hunted that whole canyon as well as ridge, as well as that canyon was that ridge. So I'm not going right. When I get to the top, I'm going to shoot left, pull him around. And I mean, his recall is awesome. I just hit him a little beep on the, I very rarely even touch stimulation with that dog. He is works in front. I mean, he'll be out 1,000 yards and I'll turn and start walking this way. And pretty soon he's looping to come in front of you. So he's really good on that aspect. But yeah, like I said, he just covers so much ground. And I mean, definitely not as much in the Chucker Hills, but like when I hit that, I really like this flatland stuff lately, because usually my boy's sitting in my pack as we're hiking. And it's a lot easier on my knees and me walking flat ground compared to hiking up a Chucker Hill with 40 more pounds on my back.
Right. Yeah. I can see the extra 40 pounds going uphill, getting old fairly quickly. My issue is always going downhill. My gas pedal works a lot better than my brakes, and my brakes, man, by the time I get down off some of those ridges, and it's just my knees and ankles are just screaming at me. It's just, you know, especially if you're carrying that extra weight, you know, every time you're stopping that momentum from going down over time, your brake pads get worn out pretty quick.
Yep. And the only issue with this 40 pounds is it doesn't sit there. It's moving back and forth.
Right.
And then you always have a little whisper in your ear. Like, I'll shoot at a cubby bird. He goes, "Hey dad, you missed." Like, thanks. He's only 4 years old. And like, when a cubby of Chucker or Huns raises, he's like, he'll yell Chucker or Huns. Like he can distinguish which birds it is, which is super fun. But going with having him on my back, like pulling my gun up, it's totally different because I'm leaning forward more, and then jumping with him on my back and not on my back, like just pulling my gun to my shoulder is totally different each time. So I'm not the world's best shot, but I'm experiencing it and having the time of my life. So,
and I think people listening to this, they're like, "Do you really have your kid in your vest?" And I can say yes, because I saw the picture you posted one the other day and tagged me in it. And it's your kid is literally standing in the back of your Final Rise vest. To give everybody kind of an understanding of the weight capability of only the vest, but yourself, right? By being able to climb those hills, like, that'll work you out real quick.
I get in Chucker shape real fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, Tyson, I enjoyed this conversation. We'll have to have you back on at some point and kind of revisit some of these topics. And it was a lot of fun. Glad we were finally able to, you know, September, October is always a hard time to pin me down and arrange a podcast episode with what you and I both love to do. But before we off here, you know, kind of tell everybody where they can find you at, maybe a link or a way to message you in case they need some help with some one-on-one training or whatever.
Exactly. So I'm located in Utah, just west of Salt Lake City in the Tooele Valley area. So anybody in that, I mean, you can come from anywhere to come help, come train with me. On Instagram, I'm T Bowden. So TBOWDEN 981X. And so that's going to be probably the best way to find me is on Instagram. And then I mean, get on there. You can ask me questions about really anything dog wise. I mean, I just want to be here to help and help people out. And main thing is just gain friendships throughout the whole process and go that route. But yeah, Instagram is going to be your best way to get a hold of me probably.
Well, I enjoyed catching up on some of your trips so far, and I look forward to hearing the crazy next adventure and what you find yourself getting into.
Hey, perfect. Well, there's a lot of craziness at my household and everything. So I've got stories upon stories. So
you kind of love to appreciate the grind, so to speak. So,
All
right. Well, guys, I appreciate it. Stay tuned for the outro and we'll catch up with Tyson at another time.
Why is it usually form or function when it comes to shotguns? You either hear about the looks or craftsmanship of this shotgun, while that shotgun over there in the corner hasn't been cleaned in 2 seasons, but supposedly fits and shoots like a dream. Why can't it be both? This is what Upland Gun Company does. They take your own personal measurements and will construct the very shotgun that should handle like a dream while getting you the looks and custom features that only you can decide on. Whether it's a side-by-side or over-under, English stock or full pistol grip, custom engraving such as your dog's portrait, even down to selecting the wood grain on your stock. Head on over to uplandguncompany.com and build the dream gun that you would carry in the field with your dog for many seasons.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that episode with Tyson Bowden. This was presented by Standing Stone Supply, Onyx Hunt, DT Systems, Upland Gun Company, and Final Rise. I always enjoy talking to somebody like Tyson, even though we've never met or shared the field in person. We share a lot of the same our reasons why for going hunting and spending so much time with our dogs. And one of the common elements through this episode, and you've heard it on a million other podcast episodes that we've done in the past, is just embracing the suck, doing what's hard. And part of the enjoyment out of this whole experience is coming away and doing things that aren't easy. Years removed from a hunt, I'm not usually thinking of the hunts or memories that came easy. I'm not usually thinking of the ones that I'm 5 minutes out of the truck and already have my limit. Don't get me wrong, those hunts and walks hold a special place in the memory bank as well. But ultimately, like, you're gonna automatically default to the hunts that you really earned. You had to grind. You had to go through the tough cover. You had to go, up some steep terrain. You spent all season chasing a bird in a low populated area to finally find success. It makes it more memorable. It makes it more fulfilling. And then by extension, just makes it more fun overall, at least in the way I look at things. And that's what I find, because it's like everything else in life. You have to earn something, right? Or else why do it? If it was easy, everybody would do it. And I think that's why a lot of people resonate and find enjoyment out of trialing and testing just as much, if not more, for some people than hunting, because you're paid off. You're getting that reward for your time and your consistency and your discipline. And it's not easy. It's difficult. So, it kind of goes into embrace the suck with everybody new coming into this. If you're listening to this and you're brand new, don't just go try and find the easy ones. Don't just ask people for spots. The fun and enjoyment, at least for me and people such as Tyson and these other people that I have the privilege to talk to on a week in, week out basis, they find pleasure and enjoyment out of the actual process of learning and getting better and improving on everything. And so take that for whatever it's worth. I'm not going to sit on my soapbox for too long and try and motivate everybody. But, I thought it was interesting that, Tyson's done a lot of cool hunts. He's gone above the border, which I haven't done, up into Canada. I hope to do that soon. And then Chungaria and chucker hunting. If you're going to be a tried and true chucker hunter, you just have to embrace the suck and realize that there are going to be certain physical requirements to succeed in a hunt such as that it's going to take some effort, and you're not going to go out there and it's not going to be flat land. You're not going to just go walk. You're going to have to try and put in some effort. So anyway, take that for whatever it's worth. Not going to keep you too much longer. If you're interested, Patreon, patreon.com/gundogyourself. If you check that out, I did just throw up a couple quick training videos I did over the holiday week a couple weeks ago, and some people really kind of reached out. They kind of enjoyed that. I'm starting to do a little bit more bonus content, or intend to. So check that out if that's interesting to you. And then if you haven't already, if you're first brand new to this, whether you're listening in your car, on your audio device, if you're watching this on YouTube, then just hit that subscribe and follow button. That way you will not miss the next episode that will be coming out shortly. And we really do appreciate it. Thanks as always for tuning in and checking us out and hitting download. It means the world to us. And we'll talk soon. Thanks, guys. Hey Everyone seems to have the same questions or concerns when they start trying to decide which kennel to purchase for their vehicle. Perhaps it's time to stop asking all the questions and just design the perfect setup that meets your exact needs. BPro Kennel specializes in designing and fabricating custom premier dog boxes handcrafted right here in the USA from high-grade, lightweight aluminum. They'll get you set up with the size dimensions, lighting, storage, battery boxes with solar charging, and anything else you can dream of. Stop stressing over buying the wrong setup just after replace it again in a year. Go ahead and check out BProKennels.com and get exactly what you want.
If you're considering changing your dog's food soon, then be sure to check out Eukanuba Pro Performance. Their science-backed formulas are designed to take your dog to the next level of performance. They also now have the new puppy formula to help your pup start strong and live active. When looking at all the different food options, remember Eukanuba to help power their ultimate performance.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Bob from Lone Ducks Gun Dog Chronicles podcast. I hope you just enjoyed the episode you just listened to. And if you did, I think you'll enjoy hopping on ours. We've got professional retriever trainers and upland bird dog trainers from across the country and world sharing their tips and tricks and great stories to help you and your dog get ready for the season. We'll see you there.